Blog Talk Radio.
Hit a body, went wide. Kucherov! Oh, did he just get crumbled?
He did.
A big hit.
Oh, they not call a penalty on that. Holy dumping. Oh, boy.
The whole bench yelling at Cronwall.
Welcome to episode 69 of the Detroit Sports Show. We're going to get right into it. We have Chris Burke on the line, Max Mara on the line. You can follow him at ChrisBurke_SI, and you can find Max at SportsGuyTheMax on Twitter. You can follow me at Drew_Tomlinson. We're just going to get right in it. I'm not happy. We're coming on the air just after the Department of Player Safety has issued a one-game suspension to Nicholas Cronwall for his hit on Kucherov in game 6 at Joe Louis Arena, a Cronwalling by the fans, an illegal check by the NHL. They ruled it as a charge, not unnecessary contact to the head or making the head a principal point of contact. So we're just going to get right into it. Chris, I'm sort of speechless. I'm pretty furious because they don't call these things consistently. I mean, there's a GIF out there of Kalat hitting Glendening in the head after Johnson starts to send him down. Garrison hit guys in the head. PK Subban took out a guy's wrist and broke it, and they ruled his one-game, in-game, you know, getting kicked off the ice was his one-game suspension. I mean, how is the NHL supposed to continue to function as a league with players not knowing what is and isn't fair?
Well, I think that's the problem. We might have to come up with something to bleep ourselves here as we talk about this, because I have a feeling. That's the issue. I think if you just take that hit in a bubble and look at what the NHL is trying to get rid of, NFL too doesn't want hits to the head, but the NHL is trying to get rid of, you could understand the suspension, I think. It was a high hit. He didn't extend the elbow, but he caught him with the elbow. I mean, it was to the head. I can understand if you're just separating everything out individually and looking at it. Okay, I get it. But those things you mentioned, those guys didn't get suspended. I think you could add Ovechkin in there. I think you could add Shea Weber throwing Henrik Zetterberg's face into the glass at the end of that game a couple years ago. I mean, pick any number of examples for guys that didn't get suspended. And then the other things you mentioned, that they spent it in because they ruled it charging. And even though in their eyes he's not, this isn't like his sixth issue with them. It's really hard to wrap my mind around getting to the point where you suspend a guy for a game 7 of a playoff series for this, given what else has been let go this year. And like I said, that's admitting that it should have been a penalty, that it probably was worthy of a hearing and a huge fine. It's really tough, I think, and it'll be really tough for the Red Wings to figure out just based on what else has gone on this year.
I think that's my big issue, too, and you mentioned it. It should have been a penalty. It's a bad hit. As a Red Wings fan, which I think we all know we are, I mean, let's not try to act like we're above this. We are. We all root for the team. We all can admit it's a bad hit. It was vicious. It was what the kind of hit that is. I'm not trying to get into victim blaming, but it is a hit that they're trying to eliminate from the game. But it is one that is sort of incidental. Kucherov does have his head down. He is hunched over a little bit, and he gets lit up. But the issue I have, and Max, what I want to hear from you is whether or not you think he would have been suspended or not, is this notion that the Department of Player Safety has put out there that if you are penalized in the game for the infraction, say Cornwall gets a 5-minute major for charging or elbowing and a 10-minute misconduct when, again, let's be real, they weren't winning anyway. Max, is he suspended or do you think he's fined, and is that fair?
Well, you know, like you said, I think it's probably not a suspension, but my opinion is I think this whole thing is what makes this ridiculous for me is, you know, I wish that the NHL would start to look at things based on what happens to the actual player that's the victim here. You know, I mean, if somebody slashes a wrist and they're out, that player that did it should be out as long as that occurred. You know, this hit to me, and this is why I think it's ridiculous that he was suspended, was, you know, he got right up. Kucherov gets right up, and he's you know, he's not, he hasn't lost any time. He's not out for the game. He's not eliminated. His status is not in doubt for Game 7. So, you know, as vicious as it looked, as vicious as it was, I don't think he should be suspended. Like we've said, like you said, fine him. And yeah, it's, I mean, it makes the NHL look so ridiculous when, you know, that certain things are fine, certain things are long suspensions, certain things aren't. I mean, there's so many different gray areas that you don't know what's black and white, and that's, I think, what's most disappointing to me, especially in the playoffs, because this is when you need, you know, players need to be on deck for their teams. And, you know, if you hurt somebody and you eliminate them, then that player should be eliminated as long as the other player. And I would have no problem with that if this was the case with Cronwall. But, you know, I think for Cronwall, I think this is a reputation penalty. And, you know, the whole thing about Cronwall and, you know, kind of being a cult hero in Detroit for these hits he's laid out, everybody watches him on the Internet. Everybody's seen the one he laid on Havlat against Chicago all those years ago. You know, he laid some big
clean
ones. Yeah, also clean.
Which was cleaner than this hit, to be honest.
Much cleaner. So he's developed this kind of a cult personality now. And I think that's what that ultimately harmed him in this situation. You know, it looked real violent, looked terrible. Even though it wasn't, you know, even though he wasn't really hurt, nobody was hurt, it wasn't a big deal, you know, they just decided to go with the suspension, which, you know, I think all of us disagree with. And I think all of us disagree with the way the NHL handles these things. There's no black or white. It's all this giant gray area where certain things can be suspension and certain things can't. I mean, that's why I love that old site on the Internet where you go to it and it's the NHL Wheel of Justice. You know, you click it and type in what the situation is, and it'll, you know, spit out some arbitrary fine or arbitrary suspension. And I think sort of that's kind of the way they do things. So, you know, yeah, it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating for the Red Wings and their fans that they have to lose Cronwall for a very important Game 7 tomorrow night.
I have no disbelief in my mind that there will be another lockout. I mean, we all can agree that that's going to happen. And number one on the ballot, if this continues, in my opinion, will be the fact that these players have absolutely zero ability to appeal this. None. There's no way for them to go and say that I don't think this is fair. And that's the worst part. And to me, the biggest mockery of the whole thing was in their video. They start to look at other Cronwall hits, which he's not a repeat offender. There's no reason to break down past hits. Sure, they're trying to say it's over the line, but what they're doing is building a case as he's a line walker. And that's not fair. It's not fair to Cronwall as a player, not to us as fans. It doesn't matter. I mean, finally pay the money to go into the game and watch him play. And we don't matter, but Cronwall is now labeled as a repeat offender for a traditionally clean player. So moving past all that, I think we have a lot to break down with this team. They did go into the game last night with the ability to close it out. And if Ken Holland would like to pick up the white courtesy phone in the airport, he's left his team at the baggage claim because they didn't show up in the first period. So, you know, Chris, what happened? I mean, what do you even go from here? Now you're missing Cronwall, and you just played a pretty big stinker on the ice yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as worried about the game. I think they bounced back. To some extent, this is just what the team is now. I don't know that they're a team that can – and we saw it really outside of that West Coast swing where they dominated. You know, how often do they run off 4 or 5 great games in a row? It just doesn't happen with this team anymore, and you can blame it on youth. You can blame it on you know, defense, goaltending, but they're an up-and-down team, and that's something I think that they have come to terms with. And, you know, I think it's also why Mike Babcock was moved on pretty quickly last night. I mean, his press conference right away saying, all right, it's over, let's go, whatever. Game seven, we'll go. We got to go win there. I mean, I think that's the attitude they have to take. They've won there twice, and we've seen this series as much as any series really that I can remember, the previous game has had no carryover at all for the next game. I mean, it hasn't been two games in a row. No team's won two in a row. Momentum's been totally wiped on the day off. So I don't worry about the performance in game six as much as, yeah, Cronwall now not being there is a gigantic loss for them. Cronwall to Kindle or Marchenko is a big drop off. And also you're going on the road, and so you give Tampa Bay back its edge with the line changes, and we've seen how much Tyler Johnson can hurt this team. And, you know, I assume the power play advantage won't be for Detroit what it was in game six. I mean, there's going to be a lot of factors working against Detroit in this game. So I don't worry about it because of what happened in game six. I worry about it because what's setting up for game seven.
Max, I mean, what's your confidence level on Alexei Marchenko or Jakob Kindle coming in to fill in for Cronwall, and which of the two would you choose? I mean, Marchenko's a little bit more stay-at-home with the right-handed shot, and Kindle has that offensive ability.
I would lean towards Kindle only because of his experience. We saw him in that Chicago series a couple of years ago play pretty well. But, yeah, I mean, you can't really have confidence in either at this point. I mean, you know, Marchenko has looked good, but he's still young. And Kindle is a bit part player at best, or else he would have already been in there. So, you know, there's not a whole lot of reason to feel optimistic and as far as the defense is concerned. But like Chris said, I think the one thing that fans can take hope in is that, you know, this has been such a wild and unpredictable series. I mean, you know, you expect the Red Wings to win that game, that they're up 2-0 at home in game four, then they blow out, they fail the last 10 minutes of that game, and then they lose. And so you think, okay, well, they're dead in the water going there to Tampa. Then they win, you know, 4-0 in dominating fashion, blow them out, essentially. So you think, okay, well, they're going to come home and they're going to play well in front of the crowd. They get worked in every facet of the game, and they lose 5-2 last night. So, you know, really, I guess, you know, you just got to throw your hands up and say, well, you know, we'll see. It's game seven. And as the old adage goes, anything can happen in game seven. And in this series, I think it's true more than any other because, you know, no one team in this series has won consecutive games. And I think that stat that's pretty telling. So I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to decide whether or not I think it, you know, the loss of Cronwall is going to mean a whole lot. Yes, it will from a leadership standpoint and from a guy being back there. But, you know, I mean, who knows? You know, who knows what can happen in game seven? You know, somebody, you could throw Kindle or Marchenko out there and he could end up scoring the goal that wins them the game in the way this series has gone. So there's not a whole lot of reason to feel confident, but the Red Wings have won two games in Tampa and have looked very good in doing so in different facets, from Mrazek being a star in the first game to the offense really stepping up in the power play in that Game 5 win. So, you know, there's some building blocks and there's some things to be hopeful about, but I don't know if you really feel confident about anything at this point in time.
I think it's going to be Kindle.
I just threw up in my mouth. I just don't. I mean, the reason I don't like it is it means you're looking at a Kindle Erickson pairing because you're not splitting Smith and Zidlicky or Jidlitsky or whatever your name, whatever they're calling him, not showing up on the ice too. And you're not splitting up Danny DeKeyser and Kyle Quincy because that's probably been your best pairing. But let's not forget, Quincy's suffering from an ankle issue. So
they
can
did
he
split up DeKeyser and Quincy. They split up DeKeyser and Quincy before Smith got back in the lineup. So I wouldn't be surprised if they went that route again. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just throwing Marchenko in for a game seven it'd be a lot. Kindle moves pretty well. I think, you know, he can get the puck out. He can give you some offensive punch, jump up on plays. I mean, he's not in any way, shape, or form a replacement for Cronwall, but I think the way he plays is probably more similar to Cronwall style than Marchenko. So just from that standpoint and from the experience standpoint, I think it's probably him. But, yeah, I mean, it's a big loss no matter how you he cut it. I just everyone else has to, the top four guys have to be much better than they have been because you have such a huge drop off at that Cronwall spot.
Who are you calling the top four? I mean, you have Erickson, Quincy, DeKaiser, and then who's the fourth?
I mean, I think Smith's been good. I think Smith's been really good for them in this series. And he's been physical. DeKaiser, I mean, the problem with DeKaiser is you're still talking about a second-year player who didn't go through the playoffs last year. So you're seeing some of those mistakes. I mean, the overtime goal was in game four was a total mental error by DeKaiser. He and Glendening had the mix-up to open the scoring in game six. I mean, you're still getting some of those mistakes. So this really falls on whichever guy comes into the lineup has to be really good. But I think Erickson and Quincy both have to be, especially Erickson, have to be way better than they have been. Erickson's been pretty mediocre all year. And then the other guy, I mean, if Cronwall hadn't been suspended, I think we could be talking right now about whether they should sit Jedlicki for Marchenko or Kindle, because Jedlicki's been atrocious and he's done nothing on the power play, which is where he was supposed to be the biggest help. So across the board, they have to be at the absolute top of their game to have any hope of replacing Cronwall.
Oh, Jedlicki scored his one bar down power play goal and we wanted to sign him for all of eternity, and then he's done absolutely nothing. Max, I mean, where is your confidence level on their ability to win next game?
Well, not very high, but, you know, like I said, I mean, anything can happen in Game 7, you know, and especially in this series. It's just been such a wild, absolutely wild series. This series is kind of making me question that I knew anything about the hockey playoffs coming in, because, you know, you always remind yourself, this is the playoffs, anything can happen. And I remember saying that last week, you know, anything can happen. I expected them to play well at home. Well, they did in the first game. And then they had that, you know, they had a really strong start in Game 4, and they just fall asleep for 10 minutes, and it costs them. I mean, I was stunned that they could have blown that game the way they did, with the fact that they had Tampa just running around, confused, just so totally frustrated. So I guess, for, you know, on the flip side of that is, you know, that should lend confidence to the Red Wings fans, the fact that, you know, things happen in the playoffs. It's crazy. You know, people that you never expect can come up for one day and be a hero and score a game-winning goal that you'd never expect that they would score, you know, and people that you expect to score, like a guy like Stamkos, who's done nothing in the whole series, or a guy like Zetterberg, who's done nothing, you know, on the score sheet in the whole series. Those two don't do anything. But a guy like Glendening is playing a leading role, and then Shane and all these guys that you would never expect. So, you know, I think that's the crux of anybody who roots for the Red Wings should feel confident in the fact that, look, you know what, stranger things have happened. I mean, they've already won twice in Tampa Bay. They seem to have, you know, they have a good following down there. I mean, you know that a lot of the crowd will be Red Wings fans down there. You know that they've already had the confidence, so they've won there twice. They've survived the first game in which Mrazek was facing a shooting gallery. They won that one. Then they won a blowout. So they've won in both ways there. And I think that gives them a little bit of confidence to rely on. Now, I wouldn't say that I feel totally confident that they'll walk in there and win another one, because, you know, I just think at this point they had their chance to win that game six at home. They should have won it. They should have eliminated them when they had the chance, and now you've opened yourself up for whatever happens. And they should have played much better down the stretch in game four to win that game. But anything can happen, and, you know, it's just going to be great theater to watch regardless of what happens.
I think we're way off the schedule, so we're just going to go anyway.
Sort of reminds me. Yeah, I mean, this kind of reminds me a little bit of the Coyotes series a few years ago, where they lost game one. It kind of went reversed because they lost games one and three, but it was 2-2, and then they went into Phoenix and won game five pretty convincingly, came home and got clobbered. I think it was the same score. I think it was 5-2. They just laid a total egg, and everyone was, oh, let's forget it. And, this, you know, that Phoenix team was not what this Lightning team is. The Tampa Bay team is better than that, but then the Wings came back and won game seven, 6-1. So it reminds me a lot of that series. I mean, 6-1 Wings win in game seven obviously would be great. I don't expect it, but That's the only series that I can really think of where things went so against the grain on a game-to-game basis that it was left Game 7. Game 7s are unpredictable by nature, but that Game 7 particularly felt similar to this one, where it felt like the Wings were going to be in big trouble going in because of how they had gotten to Game 7, and then they came out and just dominated. And I think the Cronwall thing can be a rallying point for them. You know, Babcock said even today, I don't think he's going to be suspended. Look at these other hits. You know, the NHL needs to show some consistency. I think we'll have him. Now he's suspended. So if there was any worry at all about their motivation, it can be sort of demoralizing to lose Cronwall, but I think with the rest of the guys in that locker room, you're going to see them use it as a little extra juice. You know, now really no one expects us to win. I think all the pressure, without question, is on Tampa Bay for this game.
Oh, well, totally. I mean, they're the team that was swept last year when they were supposed to be good. There was a couple of years ago, they had the supervillain as their coach, Guy Boucher, I think, and you know, they took the Caps down in four and then didn't do anything. And so they certainly have expectations. I think the guy that I'm most surprised with not showing up in this series is Henrik Zetterberg. He's the captain. People always made the argument that, well, Datsyuk was flashier, Zetterberg was the better player. And I have to admit, as a fan, a little concerned to see the drop-off in Zetterberg. He never really has had that captain's moment, right? He's had moments of them. I think last year in the playoffs, he scored a big goal a couple years ago against Anaheim. I don't really remember. But he hasn't had that captain's moment. And now you look at where Zetterberg is, he's not getting any younger, and you look at a Babcock that's ready to walk away. What happens if they lose this series? I mean, I'm starting to wonder whether or not losing a game seven is I'm trying to think of the right idiom here, but I'm not, you know, the stake in the coffin for Babcock, that he's gone. I mean, that was always what we said coming into the season, right? It's unacceptable that this team doesn't make it past the first or second round. We said they'd either have to make it to the conference final or go deep into the second round to be confident with Babcock continuing. Max, is that still the case? I mean, if they lose tomorrow, that is still another first-round exit. So to go back in time, you had a first-round exit this year, last year, the year before they blew a 3-1 lead on the Blackhawks. The year before that, they lost in the second round of the Sharks. The year before that, they lost the second round of the Sharks. And then you lose in the cup final of the Penguins the year before that. Where do you go from with Babcock?
Well, I think you're right. And for me personally, I think this is not going to be an unpopular opinion with a lot of people. But you know what? If they end up losing this game, if he walks away, I don't feel a lot of depression or disappointment about that decision. Because what you said, now the Stanley Cup they won in 2008 came with an annihilation repeating in 2009, like you mentioned. After that, it's just been a mixed bag of, you know, failure here and not getting the job done there. I mean, they had that, I think the one that sticks out for me the most still is that 3-1 lead they had on the Hawks. And that moment where, you know, they come back, you know, they come back home and they lose that game in such crushing fashion, and they have the lead in the third period, and then they take it all the way to game seven and they lose in overtime. I think that was the moment where I kind of said, well, you know, I mean, this is where coaching pulls you through there. And, you know, the players have to do a certain amount themselves, and they had done a ton in that series. But something about that game did not sit well with me. And then ever since then, it's just been, you know, a string of, you know, last year, that was a frustrating year. And then this year, it's frustrating because the Red Wings had this feel of the team, you know, early in the season that you thought, okay, they've surprised people. They're going to sneak up on some people and make some noise. Then you get them in the playoffs, and there's no consistency. And that's the problem I've had for these last handful of years. There's just been no consistency. And the team hasn't been able to get the job done. And to me, you know, that screams maybe there's a need for a new voice. I mean, you know, it's like the Pistons when they had all these different advancements to the finals, and they just had absolutely no, you know, connection with their coach, and all of a sudden it's like, boom, they need a new voice. And now Joe Dumars screwed that up, of course, because he introduced way too many voices. But the point remains is that, you know, after a while, and like you mentioned, this nucleus isn't getting any younger. I mean, you've got Zetterberg, Datsyuk, these guys, Cronwall, they're aging, and they've got a lot of young talent around them, but I just question whether or not the direction is correct at this point. And a loss in Game 7, where, you know, you wouldn't expect the Red Wings necessarily to win, quote-unquote, because they were the lower-seeded team and they kind of limped into the playoffs based on seed alone, you would still have to say, okay, they had a lead in this series 3-2 coming home for Game 6, and they couldn't get it done, and then they lost in Game 7. That would, to me, at that point, I would say whatever happens with Babcock, I'm okay with. And I wouldn't cry about his departure, and I wouldn't be frustrated one bit myself.
Chris, are you comfortable with Jeff Blashill, who I'm assuming if Babcock leaves, that's who it will be. Are you comfortable with him running the squad, or do you think Babcock has done enough against a good Lightning team to warrant the highest contract ever paid to an NHL head coach?
Well, first of all, I don't know how much of this the Wings will have a say in. And Babcock might be feeling the same sort of things and want to go somewhere else for a fresh start, because I think it's been interesting to watch sort of the development of this team and how it's unfolded the last few years, because the way that, especially this year, the way that this series has played out is sort of an exact opposite of how the Wings series played out during their heyday, during, you know, when they were that late 90s, 2000s dynasty, and every team went into the series talking about, you know, if we get to Game 6, get to Game 7, we'd feel pretty good, clutching and grabbing, trying to grind out wins. And the Wings have become that team. And now Babcock, you know, well, if we were 2-2, if you told us we'd be 2-2 going into the series, we'd be thrilled. If you told us we'd get to Game 7, we'd be thrilled. And so it's sort of interesting to hear that, and I wonder if the bar is not where it used to be internally. I mean, I think it made it a big focus to continue the playoff streak, but I don't know that they necessarily think that they are Stanley Cup favorites on a year-to-year basis, and they haven't been the way that it's played out. So does that mean that they need to change, you know, Ken Holland's time's up? Does that mean Babcock's time's up? I'm not really sure. I think another first-round exit, I'm with Max. I think Babcock is a great coach, and we've seen that time and again, especially in the regular season, but, you know, he won the cup here. He's a great coach, but if it wasn't Mike Babcock, if the last 4 or 5 years had played out the way they have under really any other coach, I think the Wings would have fired him by now, honestly. Sneaking into the playoffs, early exits, and they haven't been in the conference finals in years. I mean, at some point, even the best coaches have to kind of put their feet to the fire and wonder if they've done as much as they can. We might be at that point with him, whether it's his own fault or not. I think the roster has had issues, but I just think we might be at that point. And it's sort of a natural point if it happens because his contract's up.
I think it's interesting that you talk about the players, because a lot of people call Mike Babcock the best coach in hockey. I think he's got a track record to be able to back that up. But when you look at what he's actually succeeded with, you're looking at a Stanley Cup winning team that was essentially an all-star team with Datsyuk and Zetterberg in their prime, Lindstrom, Rafalski. You had the Dominator who got you through the regular season, and then Osgood who went through and got you to the Cup Finals. The next year you came back and you added Hossa into the mix. And then you have two Canada teams that might be two of the greatest constructed hockey teams ever in the history of organized hockey that went and won the gold medal. So it's not as if Babcock has ever – I'm not saying that he hasn't, but he doesn't exactly have a track record of winning with – less like other coaches may have. I think Todd McClellan is one we could say. He's done a lot on the Sharks with really only a handful of players for a long, long time. I mean, they were in the playoffs for 10 years.
There's your new head coach.
Well, yeah. That's what I was thinking.
I don't know if I like that.
I mean, I just, like, look at game four. And we're talking, Glenn Denning gets hurt, goes out, and then they melt down and everyone, oh,
take
man,
a time
what
out.
A defensive. what a defensive breakdown. Well, how do you allow Tyler Johnson's line to score three goals on you with this basically the same matchup? It was Datsyuk's line all three times. I mean, that to me is a coaching issue. And again, I think Babcock is a great coach. I would love for him to stick around. But I also think that that Stanley Cup run, the back-to-back years of getting to the finals, winning the one cup, and his reputation around the league and around the hockey world have sort of kept him from getting too much criticism outside of, you know, why are you playing Dan Cleary? I mean, that sort of thing. I don't think he gets a lot of criticism in spots where he could get criticism. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is a big game for his future in Detroit and what the Wings do, because I think you can justify a lot more easily letting him walk if you get bounced again on Wednesday.
And that's what I thought. I thought if you get bounced on Wednesday and you don't make it all the way to the conference finals or you don't make it to the second round, it's a lot easier for them to say, okay, see you later. You know, even if the I mean, it's a lot easier for them not even to negotiate and say, well, you know what, that's fine. You can take that contract if you want it. And I think a lot of it also has to do with Ken Holland. I mean, let's not forget his role in this whole thing. You know, I mean, he's drafted a lot of these great players and he's setting up the Red Wings for success. Yes, but at the same time, you know, I think we've all had issue with why the heck isn't Pulkkinen on the roster at some point this year, and you know, why is he still toiling away in Grand Rapids? I mean, they've gotten to the point where they have so much young talent that it's hard to manage. But, you know, and then you hear him on the radio, and, you know, Matt Derry always loves to play the clip. Kids aren't the answer. And, you know, I don't know. I think a certain amount of – I get the feeling that there's a certain amount of stagnation in that front office right now. And it's Ken Holland, and it's Babcock – and it's a whole lot of people that have been together for a really long time. And, you know, maybe there needs to be one, you know, and I think in those situations, I feel like there's one strike of a match, and it's a very dry climate in there. If there's one match strike, the whole thing could go up in flames, and certain things could, you know, certain people could lose their jobs or other people could be let walk. Now, the Red Wings organization is very loyal and almost to a fault in these situations. So I think, you know, I put a little bit of blame with Ken Holland as well for the way he's constructed things recently. So it'll be interesting to see. And you know, the idea that Blashill is his coach in waiting if Babcock leaves. I mean, that's some groupthink right there. Like, oh, well, you know, this guy is so good in Grand Rapids. We're all the smartest people in the room. We're just going to promote him if Babcock, who we think is the greatest coach of ever, just leaves without even looking at, you know, around the league to see. I mean, think about it. The old days, the Red Wings, if the Red Wings' job was open, everybody else would be all ears at that point because they'd all want to take it because it would be that much in demand. So, you know, I don't think that that's a very good strategy. I think if Babcock did leave, they would have to open it up and, you know, not necessarily lean one way and put all their eggs in that one basket, but kind of have an open mind as to how things need to be fixed and what they need to do next to get over the hump.
All right. We've talked about putting Mike Babcock's feet to the flame. We're going to have to let our dear leader, Chris Burko, it's his birthday today, so we're going to let him cut out early, take the evening off in preparation for his wonderful birthday gift of three straight days of NFL coverage. So we're going to put our feet to the flame.
I'm 33 years old now, or in mock draft age, 207. So,
you've only got like two more to do because then you've got to do your new first round mock and then you have to do your second and third round mock off of the first round that actually happened. So happy birthday to Chris, but we're going to go Heat to the Flames. We're going to go Max first and then Chris. Max, who wins tomorrow?
The Lightning. I don't see the Red Wings getting it done.
That might be the first time anyone's ever picked against the Detroit team on here. We've ever had that happen. Well, I uploaded this audio clip, so I may as well play it, right? I mean, I saved it.
I'm so excited! I'm so excited! I'm so scared!
That pretty much sums it up for me. I feel pretty, what a worry. I mean, I'm going to pick them, because why the hell not at this point? I'm going to pick the Wings to win. I mean, I still think he looked back at this is a young Wings team, but this is still a pretty inexperienced Lightning team that now has all the pressure in the world on it, a goaltender that has been pretty shaky. And we talked about Zetterberg not showing up. Stamkos still hasn't shown up. I don't think maybe he has a big game, but it's hard to just flip that switch. So I think it's going to be ugly. I think it's going to be low scoring. And that sort of game plays to the Wings' favor. So why not? I think they win 2-1. Who knows? And goals by Jakob Kindle and Landon Ferraro.
The trifecta of a win with Ferraro and Kindle. I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to pick the Wings, only because I think Ben Bishop might cry into a soup at any point in time. He looks so nervous at all times. So I'll take Bishop over. I'll take Mrazek over Bishop and the Wings to win. And probably some ridiculous game where someone gets headshotted and then there's some bench clearing brawl probably, and Babcock punches out John Cooper or something. So with that, we're going to send you off, Chris. Chris, enjoy the rest of the evening. Thank you for joining us for the evening.
Yep. Enjoy the game tomorrow, fellas. As much as you can enjoy it.
Alcohol fueled, I'm sure, is what I will be. And with that, Mac, we're going to transition to a much lighter, more interesting subject. The NFL draft, one of my favorite days of the year. Just your general thoughts. I mean, we ran over a little bit on the wing, so what do you think about the Lions and the draft going in? We haven't really talked Lions in a long time.
Well, I think it's a very interesting spot that they're in, because I think at 23, you know, there's a lot of different things that can happen. You can have, you know, that's a spot where a lot of people that are in the mid rounds, you know, the teens, can slip down a little bit further than you expect, which A, can help you make a trade if you want to trade down. Everybody knows that they don't have a fourth round pick. They just picked up a fifth rounder because of the George Johnson trade. So maybe that allows them to pick up an extra second round pick, pick up a third round, you know, some middle round picks, which could help. Also, you could stay right where you are and take a defensive lineman. There's a lot of defensive tackles. You know, a guy like Eddie Goldman, a guy like Jordan Phillips from Oklahoma, he's there, may be there in that spot. Or you could take offensive line. There's always offensive linemen that always come off the board right about there. They're usually pretty solid. Or, you know, that's always a spot where we know Martin Mayhew. He loves that best player available. So there's probably going to be no shortage of wide receivers. Maybe a Breshad Perriman makes it there. Maybe a guy like Melvin Gordon, running back, or Todd Gurley, one of those two may be there. So it's an interesting spot. There's a lot of different ways they could go and a lot of different ways that they may choose to go. But I don't think we know where they're leaning. There hasn't been really any clear-cut indication of where they're leaning. A lot of wide receivers visiting, a lot of defensive linemen visiting, so it's hard to get a gauge of it, but it's a very good spot, and it's a very good spot for options. So if you like options, you'll like this draft for the Lions at 23.
I would think, other than the Tennessee Titans pick, this might be the most tradable draft pick in the whole draft. There's a lot of good talent that will fall at 23 that I don't think the Lions are sold on any of it. I thought they've had a pretty strong offseason. Some people don't like it, but you essentially reloaded a defensive tackle cheap. I mean, Haloti Ngata is not the cheapest, but I mean, it's not as if you went out and overpaid for a defensive tackle to replace Sue and Fairley. And I think people overstated Fairley's value on the team, to be quite honest, because I didn't really see him on the field all that often. So I thought they'd done a nice offseason. They got rid of Reggie, who, let's be real, kind of put the offense into the mud a little bit at times when you see the play there and he just couldn't quite hit the hole and get through it. So I think there could be a team that does a little bit of addition by subtraction, and I wouldn't be shocked if this team played just as well without Ndamukong Suh as if they played with him. The bigger surprise would be, what if they played better? They didn't exactly finish strong on defense. I mean, is that – you cover the team more than I do. You saw them at training camp. I mean, they didn't exactly finish strong, and they got churned up a little bit in the running game, especially in that game at Green Bay. Is it that strange to think the Lions could be better without Sue?
Not at all from my – where I sit. I mean, I think that's actually a valid point. Look, I mean, what did the Lions accomplish with Sue in the fold? They made the playoffs twice, lost both times. It's not like we're talking about a guy who, you know, is going to change the franchise just by keeping him in his spot. You know what he's going to give you. He's going to give you a lot of double teams in the middle, which is going to open up a lot of sacks for Ziggy Ansah and guys like that on the outside. Okay, you'll lose a little bit of that. But you had a guy like Cody Nada, like you said, can command the same double teams, put the same heat on the quarterback. Maybe he's just not as much of a sack man as Sue is, or a pressure man, but he can eat up the running game just like Sue can, and I think that's very important. So, you know, I think people tend to overvalue what Sue did for the Lions these last few years. I mean, he was one of the best, graded the best defensive tackles in the game, and there's all these lavish stats and praise. But for as great as he was, he had all those other question marks about, you know, cleanness of his game and all these other things that are going to follow him around until the day he retires. And at the end of the day, I think it's actually quite positive that the Lions have removed themselves from this and you know, did not make him the highest paid defensive tackle in NFL history. It ate up an entire chunk of their salary cap. I think they can play better without him because I think that, like we've said, you know, this guy that they signed, Tyron Walker, he's very, very good. A lot of people were exceptionally high on him. And the Patriots wanted to sign him, for Pete's sake. So they must have done something right on that. And then you plug in a young guy. I mean, you draft somebody. You know, one of my favorite players in this whole draft, I think, is a kid from Detroit by the name of Carl Davis from Iowa. You plug somebody like that into the line, along with Nada and along with Walker, kind of a three-headed monster. You can get by without Sue. So I think they may lose a little bit in the short term as far as there may not be those open lanes for guys like Ziggy Ansah just because of double teams. But I still think that as a franchise, they're going to come out ahead because they don't have that salary cap tied down. And they don't have this guy who is kind of a rogue guy bringing negative press to the team that you weren't really sure whether he was, you know, on board or not, or 100% or not, or he's crying after the game in Dallas, and so you think he's real sincere, but was that contrived? So wave goodbye to all that and just get down to the business of winning. And I don't think it's crazy at all to think that they might actually come out ahead after getting rid of Sue and watching him walk.
Oh, well, you got to think, too. I mean, they're not realistically that far from having their cap in line, and Stafford's paid a lot, and Johnson's paid a lot, and they're certainly going to have to pay Levy, but they're not that far from actually having a rather manageable salary cap, which is exciting. Enough of the offseason and free agency. It was our quick hitter. Let's dive into the actual draft. I've done absolutely no preparation for this, so this should be ridiculously exciting for us. We're going to do a three-round mock, Max. Let's go round by round. We'll start with the first round. Who do you think the Lions select?
Well, I think they've got him taking a guy by the name of Cameron Irving from Florida State, an offensive lineman. He can play a little bit of center, play a little guard. He plays all the different positions. He's kind of a versatile Swiss Army knife. And I think if they stay at that pick 23, there's going to be a lot of tempting options. You know, like I said, a guy like Perriman might be there. You know they're going to want to pull the trigger on another receiver. You know they're going to want to do it. But please, do not do it. I've been arguing against it for weeks. You do not need to take a receiver in the first round. You know they might want to take a guy like Melvin Gordon. I think there's better running backs in the middle rounds. I think you can get a guy like Tevin Coleman, a guy like Amir Abdullah in the second round. Michigan State's Jeremy Langford, who, I'm not just saying this because I'm a Michigan State alum, I think he's one of the most underrated running backs of this entire draft. I mean, I think he had a string of 16 straight games in the Big Ten, over 100 yards. Now, the Big Ten's not great, but you are including teams like Penn State on the road and Ohio State, who had a great defense last year. So there's other players that you can get. So I'm going to go with the offensive lineman in the first round. I think he comes from a winning situation. Irving was a great player for Florida State, played in a lot of big games, and I think he's the kind of guy that, you know, considering what they've lost on the offensive line, they need a guy who's versatile and can fit in a bunch of different spots. So I think Irving is the perfect pick for them at 23.
Interesting. It's interesting because I have thought that the one guy that I do not think they're going to take is Cameron Irving. I don't know why, and I don't discount everything you've said. I think they're just really set on Swanson at center, and I really think Cameron Irving is a future center. I don't know. I don't understand how Mayhew does it. I just have some hunch that they want to stay away from anybody that could play center because they really want to set Swanson up for center.
It's possible. They did use Swanson a lot last year.
And he wasn't bad. He wasn't amazing. Mayhew tends to, if you've noticed in his tenure, he stays away from drafting players that cause position controversies, which is really interesting if you think about the way that he looks at that. Because we've seen it happen. I mean, if you look at the corners, we hated all of them, so there was no way to argue that one of them needed to be in. But the one place that there was a little bit of positional controversy was definitely at tight end last year. They seem to really, really hate that.
Year if nobody catches any passes.
I hope that I envision that all Eric Ebron did all year was just stick his hands in like two giant vats of Vaseline so he can have, and then just walked around all the time with them so he could have the world's softest hands when he came back into camp because he needs to catch the ball. I'm going to go with Melton Brown. This is a boring pick. The defensive tackle, defensive end from Arizona. They've seemed in the past, I've thought, to look at a strength and then continue to make their strength better. That's how they ended up becoming so dominant on defense. They had Sue, and then they decided to get another tackle in Fairley. And then, you know, they're already pretty decent, and we all thought, well, maybe they'll get a defensive end later. They ended up getting Ansa. I think they're going to continue going down that route. I don't like the pick. I personally would like to see, honestly, something more exciting, like a Melvin Gordon or a Todd Gurley if he's there, but I think they'll play it safe. This is a big draft for Mayhew. We'll hit on that later. Any thoughts on Malcolm Brown?
Well, I like him. I don't think it's a boring pick at all. We've talked about they need another defensive tackle. If you can put a guy in there in that spot and kind of get a three-headed monster going, he can be great in a role where you don't use him every down, because if he allows that motor a chance to rest, man, he could be devastating late in the game. So, getting a guy like Malcolm Brown, who's really good, I think I did the profile on him for a sideline report. He's a humble kid. The Lions asked him about replacing Sue, and he was very upfront with them about it. So, I think that wouldn't be a bad pick at all. I mean, they need somebody in that defensive line, and they need a young player. So, outside of it's a coin flip for me. You can either take a lineman or a offensive lineman or a defensive lineman. Either way, I don't think you could lose because those positions are both positions of need. So, yeah, good pick. I'll give you a thumbs up on that one.
Damn, the expert giving me a good pick. That's the only thing I like to hear. All right, moving on to the second round. Max, who do you have?
I've got the Lions. That's where I have them taking their defensive tackle in the second round. I got them taking Carl Davis from Iowa. This kid is from Detroit, so he's kind of like that Jason Jones type, Drake Bell. They like the local kid. And Carl Davis is a guy that he did visit with them. He's not one of the most explosive players on the tape in the Big Ten, but he was quietly productive for Iowa, very good run stopper, can get to the quarterback as well. And I think that he's going to be the kind of guy that if they get him in there can really, really flourish from learning under a guy like Nada and being in that rotation. So I took Carl Davis because I thought it was a natural fit, being he's from Detroit, went away from here to go to college, but has come back recently and kind of done some work with the Lions. They've watched his tape and they've given him a pre-draft visit. So keep your eye on Carl Davis. I think if he's there in the second round, he could be proved to be a steal at some point. And certainly where the Lions pick, later part of the second round. So I'm going with the D-tackle in the second round, Carl Davis.
I don't think it's ever a bad idea to draft Iowa linemen. They always seem to just be.
Always.
Always. They're always good. It's kind of scary how they just do it.
Who was the last great Lions D lineman they got from Iowa? I know you remember the name.
I would be taking a wild guess. Jared DeVries or something, but I don't.
That's it.
You got it.
That's the one. Too bad we don't have like some Price is Right music here.
I know. We should have Chris upload that next time. I thought I'd pick the most middle American name possible. That might be offensive. I'm sorry if I offended anybody, but. All right, for the second round, I've got the Lions taking Amir Abdullah. I think they're going to take a running back. I think they're going to trade up for one. This guy's been compared to Jamal Charles. I think he's a big old question mark, but I think that he's someone that they could use. They need a change of pace. It's the only reason I'm not so on the Tevin Coleman bandwagon. Tevin Coleman is a great back, but they already sort of have one of those in Bell. So I think they're going to go for Abdullah, which is actually going to set up my third round pick. Any thoughts of Abdullah?
Well, I mean, he's another good one. You know, you watch him in the Big Ten, and he's one of the most durable runners in the Big Ten, along with Langford and Coleman. So I don't think, you know, from that trio, you can go wrong. And that's why I would lean against picking a guy like Melvin Gordon or Gurley, especially Gurley, because he's got that knee injury, and you really don't know what you're going to get from him right away. The Lions need a guy they can plug in right now. And, you know, Abdullah, one of the most productive backs, and he can pass catch on the backfield too, which the Lions like. So, yeah, I wouldn't have a problem with that one bit.
Moving on to the third round, who do you have the Lions taking?
Well, this is where I have my controversial choice. I put them in for Trey McBride, the wide receiver from William & Mary, which he visited with the Lions, which I find – I always take a close look at those pre-draft visits, especially the ones from the smaller schools, because they can be a very interesting tell as to what the team is thinking. I mean, they did bring in Perriman and all these guys who are the big-name guys, the Louisville wide receiver, whose name escapes me. But I think McBride is the kind of guy they can get in the third round, 6 feet, runs a 4.4. Good athlete, and I think that when I say that they don't need to take a wide receiver high, I mean within the first two rounds. Now, at round three and below is when you kind of start thinking. You start thinking about some of these names, a guy like Tyler Lockett from Kansas State, a guy like Jamison Crowder from Duke, these guys that are fast and they can also play on special teams may come into play. But I think they'll go with McBride. He's kind of a natural fit, deep ball threat, great skills, really, really quick. So I think that's where they'll get their wide receiver in the third round.
Interesting. I don't hate the idea of taking a wide receiver. I mean, they still really haven't gotten that slot guy locked down. It's just been sort of a rotational thing. I mean, can he – I was looking at my third round pick, so I may have missed it. Is he kick return, punt return? Is that I know they're interested in that.
I'm not sure exactly if he has that skill. I know that he may actually, because I'd have to check on it, but – he may actually have that skill if they've been looking at him. They've been looking at a lot of kick returner, punt returner types. I know Crowder, and I know Lockett, that kid from Kansas State. And also they looked at the running back from Missouri, who's got that, six touchdowns. So they've got that in there. So he may have that capability. I did not do the draft preview for him for Sideline, but I've read a little bit about him. I haven't come across that, but it's possible, very possible.
My third-round pick, I have Trey Jackson, the 6'3", 323-pound guard from Florida State, which sets up the fact that I think the Lions might actually look to run the ball more. He seems to have the same fit as Larry Warford, and I really do think that Mayhew looks at where he drafts players and thinks, oh, I'm great at drafting linemen in the third round, so I'm going to continue to draft linemen in the third round. He's a strong run blocker, physical, from what I know about him. He could be a nice fit. It seems like there's definitely some questions, especially on the passing. If they can't run the ball, I don't know how well Trey Jackson is going to do in pass pro. Do you have any thoughts on Trey Jackson?
Yeah, he's another good pick. I mean, I don't think you can go wrong, like you said, with a Florida. You know, these linemen have had success. Big linemen from big schools like Florida State. He's been in a lot of big games lately. You know, you've got that pedigree. And he's a big boy. I think it would be a very good pick if they were able to get that guard. Another guard that I like, a guy by the name of Lakin Tomlinson from Duke. I don't know if he's a relation to you. I always like kidding you about that, but he's another one that I like in that same mold. So I don't think you can go wrong by taking a guard. Like you said, kind of these Larry Warford-type guys you get in the third round, good value, and played a lot of good competition. So, yeah, I think that would be another good pick and a good value at that point in time.
Words can't describe how much I want the Lions to draft Lakin Tomlinson. I need a new
jersey. Because you're going to get the jersey. I know you're going to get
it. I'm totally going to get the jersey.
You have to.
I mean, I need a new one, and it's my last name. I got to have it. It'll be great. It'll be, and hopefully he won't be terrible, because if he is, then that would be awful. Do you have any other prospects that you're interested in the draft that aren't Lions-related? I think we all watch a lot of college football. You mentioned Jeremy Langford. Is there anyone else you're interested in?
Well, I love those two guys. You know, I've been writing about them. You know, people seem to have some disagreement here with me on this issue, and I want to clear the air with it. But I don't think the Lions should be using Golden Tate in the punt returning role, okay? I'm sorry. this guy was signed to be, you know, Batman to Calvin Johnson's, or Robin to Calvin Johnson's Batman here. Why would you line him up and set him into these car crash scenarios where these guys are flying down trying to knock his head off? I think it's just stupid. So that's why I like those guys like Lockett from Kansas State, very quick, set a lot of records at Kansas State for punt returning, kick returning, touchdowns, yardage, is also a good receiver. And Jamison Crowder from Duke, another quick guy, same way at Duke, set a lot of records there, you know, always a good punt returner. I think they can get one of those guys in the middle rounds, say like rounds 3 to 5, plug him in, use him in the slot, teach him how, as Mike Mayock said about Crowder, it's the guy you draft for speed alone because you know he can be a returner, and then you just worry about teaching him how to be a receiver. So I think they could do that and get away with it. Another guy that I find very interesting, and I did a profile on him, is Josh Shaw from USC. Remember, he's the guy that made up the story about saving his nephew from a building, and
oh,
then it was
right.
Proven to be false. Well, he's got great size, and you know, he's going to be a guy that nobody's going to want to take a chance on because he's got all these character flaws and concerns. But you forget that he's 6 foot. He can play cornerback or safety, so he's versatile. He's got that little bit of versatility in him. And, you know, the Lions may not want to draft a corner really high this year because they've got all this depth there. They've got Nevin Lawson coming back, Bill Bentley coming back, even though we like to hate on him. But they've got all these guys coming back, so they may not take one early. You get a guy like Shaw, and he can kind of fit in both roles, safety or corner. I know they like to do that sometimes, you know, mix those guys up. So I find that very interesting. That would be a very interesting pick. He's played a lot of good competition. So I look at that as a kid that maybe you take a chance on. Also, I wrote about it today, Michigan's Frank Clark. I mean, let's not forget, before he was booted from the team, had all of his legal troubles, this guy was getting to the quarterback. He had 13.5 tackles for loss, all those sacks, 42 tackles. He could be a very productive end, and they're going to need to draft probably one other defensive end or find somebody to compete for a spot, given that, you know, George Johnson is gone now and you don't really know what you have. Devin Taylor or Webster. So, you know, why not take a chance on Frank Clark as either a 6th or 7th round pick or undrafted free agent? I think it could be very intriguing if he's turned his life around, which all indications are that he's kind of gotten his head screwed on straight here. So just a couple names to remember late in the draft and as the days go on.
Yeah, I think a couple guys, I don't know if the Lions will take a look at him, but I'm obviously interested in the quarterbacks, where they go, I think everyone is. A couple of Michigan guys, I'm actually really interested to see where Devin Funchess goes. I think he was used out of position last year as a wide receiver, and it hurt him. I think he could be a very good tight end or a developmental wide receiver that could take several years. I'm interested in him. The other player I'm really intrigued by from University of Michigan is Jake Ryan, who I thought was going to be the next Clay Matthews. He was a beast before he tore his ACL, and he still wasn't really back from it last year, I have a feeling. So I'm curious to know where he goes and how his career sort of pans out. He was a very productive middle linebacker, I thought. So he could be a real steal. And the last one is Senquez Golson. He's the cornerback from Ole Miss. I'm probably butchering his name. He ran a slow 40, but man, is he an interception machine last year in 2014. I remember I watched a lot of Ole Miss when they were up in the top 5, and every time I watched, he always made a play. So I thought he could be interesting, even for the Lions. Late, he's ranked around the 14th best corner, but that might be a little under, especially if he could go ahead. I mean, 10 interceptions, second highest total on the NCAA last year. It's pretty good. So just last thought for you, Max. Do you trust Martin Mayhew with the Lions draft?
I trust him to a point. You kind of got to throw out that one draft in 2011 where he made all the mistakes and nobody's left from the team. But I think lately he's proven to be trustable. So we'll see. I mean, it's going to take, you know, now if he takes a wide receiver right away and passes on other needs, you know, maybe you start to look at it and say he's not trustworthy. But I don't know. What do you think? You trust him?
I'm going to trust him for now. I think he's actually been a little bit of an underrated general manager with a very tough spot. But he's made some good picks. I mean, if you look at the number of drafted players, the Lions don't have a lot in the late rounds, but they have a lot in the early rounds that are still on the team and pretty productive. So for now, I'm going to trust Martin Ahe. But like I said, once I start seeing wide receivers or 3 picks in the first round, I'm going to start to concern. But with that, we're going to wrap up another Detroit Sports Show. I know this was on Tuesday this week, but last week we were trying to get back to every Monday. So every Monday, same time, same place. Max, thanks for coming on. For Chris Burke, we're signing off.